Welcome to Soul of an Empath, the podcast that helps empaths to feel loved, seen, heard, and understood in all areas of your life. Now here's your host, Tiffany Cano.
Welcome to another Soul of an Empath podcast episode. Today's guest is Jenny Rock. She's going to help you break free of co-parenting triumphs. So she is coming from the UK to deliver these gifts and insights for you. So Jenny is a seasoned co-parenting without conflict expert, leveraging 4 years of experience to guide divorced parents in reshaping relationships for their children's benefit. With a proven track record, Jenny emphasizes prioritizing children's needs for effective co-parenting post-divorce. They provide practical tools for healing, communication, and positive co-parenting, acknowledging the emotional toll of divorce on parents and their children. As a sought-after speaker and consultant, Jenny shares insights nationwide, delivering engaging and empowering presentations. Whether you're a divorced parent seeking common ground or a professional expanding co-parenting knowledge, Jenny offers invaluable guidance for navigating challenges without conflict and building a brighter future for all. Welcome, Jenny, to the show.
Thank you, Tiffany, for having me. It's very kind of you.
Yeah, what got you into this line of work?
Oh, well, it was kind of a combination of circumstances that all kind of came together into a perfect storm. So I divorced from my son's father when he was three. Well, we split up when he was three, divorced when he was six. And it wasn't a happy marriage. It was an abusive marriage. And after the divorce, you kind of think, well, it's going to get better now because, you know, it's got to get better, right? That's the whole point of getting a divorce. And suddenly I realized, no, it doesn't get better. It just gets worse because the gloves are off. And then an opportunity came up when my son was 14, when I had the opportunity to retrain and start doing something else with my life. So I did. And I decided to become the person that I had needed when I was going through hell, because there wasn't any support. I didn't know where to go, who to turn to. And it was something that I felt would be needed. So
mm-hmm. Nice. And behind you, I see some books. Are those books that you've written?
One that I've written, How to Stop the Tears, Surviving Divorce. It's a bit of a kind of how-to book. The other one is I'm part of the Referral Resource Guide for Fort Worth Development Group. So they feature me in there. I've also been published in Phoenix Fitness something or other in Arizona. And I'm partway through. I've drawn up the outline for the next book, but I haven't put much more work into it than that right now. So it's a work in progress.
Okay. So tell me about a success story that you've had with some parents and their kids because I feel like going through a divorce can be very challenging. And when you've got kids and, you know, all these conflicting, opposing views on how to raise them, it's got to be a little tricky.
Oh, it definitely is a little tricky. I think a really good success story is one that I worked with fairly recently, because I only worked with one parent, because it only takes one person to change the whole dynamic. You can't have a war if only one person is fighting. So,
nice. Yeah.
It tends to be that I get the very, very dysfunctional, toxic relationships to work with, and that's fine. And this one was a guy who his daughter actually had been poorly, and he had basically completely overhauled his life to be fit for his daughter, for what she needed. And he was being blocked at every turn from seeing his child. You know, it was just every accusation, everything was being thrown at him. And he was an absolute wreck when we first started working together. And then about halfway through, so they come to me for an 8-week period, and then I kind of release them back into the wild. And it's about half, it's kind of like a proud mother hen. She sort of shoves them out of the bird nest. off they go. But bless them. I keep in touch with them all. They're lovely guys. But he'd basically put his career on hold for a number of years. And the opportunity came up to have an interview for the job that he should have taken 5 years previously. And he's now got a fantastic new job, earning more money, looking at buying his own place again, getting the contact with his child is increasing, you know, month on month. And he is no longer a soggy mess sat in the corner.
Nice.
Kind of, you know, why, you know, why me? Woe is me. You know, my life is awful. But there's so many different varieties. I've had one client who'd literally gone out that day to go and buy the equipment to hang himself in the garage to commit suicide. And luckily we just happened to chat. We just kind of connected and I sort of took him on straight away. And he's an actor, and he's now in shows, he's living his best life, he's got his kids half the time, you know, and really moving on with his life.
Do you mostly work with men?
I always thought it would be women that I was working mostly with, because I kind of thought, my first sort of foray into working for myself online was like lots of sleazy pictures of an unwanted kind that came via Facebook and places like that from the male of the species. And it really kind of made me think, oh no, I don't want to work with men. I'll just stick working with the women, which I did for the first few years. But it's almost completely flipped now. And it's mainly men that I work with. But I'm not getting any more of those horrible pictures anymore, which is good.
Nice. And it's wonderful how you've been able to help those men who've been suffering. I mean, the one who is contemplating suicide, and, you know, there's so much healing that often needs to happen when people are going through divorce. I mean, I've heard, you know, that most men feel like they're an utter failure when a divorce happens.
There's a huge ego hit, especially to men, with regards to a divorce. But there's also an awful lot of things happen behind closed doors that they feel ashamed to talk about, that they don't want to say out loud. They don't want to acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. Suicide is actually the second biggest killer of men between the age of, I think it's 21 and 45.
Wow.
Of which, you know, the statistics for men going through divorce and that number, or divorced men and that number, is very, very high. Massive number of men that just decide that life's not worth living anymore. They've lost everything. They can't cope. They don't know what to do with themselves. And they've lost all hope of ever, you know, moving on. So it's a really big taboo subject that really needs to be changed, and we need to talk about it more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's an important role to be able to create that salve for the broken heart, and then help those men and women and parents to not bleed that over onto their communication with their children.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we all see it where it just ends up full-scale war, and the kids are just stuck in between the parents, and they don't know what to say, and they don't know who to, you know, they don't know who to listen to, and there's just constantly, they're getting it from all sides, and that has such awful impact mm-hmm. on them.
So how do you help people when they're going through such challenges like that?
I think one of the first things is to give them space to offload, to let it all out, and then try and make sense of it, and, you know, sort of start to filter out, you know, sort of what means anything and what doesn't mean anything. And then it's about giving them the tools that they need to be able to fix that. So it's all very much about, I can give them the tools, but I can't make it work for them. So I can only work with somebody if they're ready to do the actual work, because a lot of people will say, oh, I can't cope with this anymore, but, you know, I don't know what to do. And, you know, it just drives me nuts. I can't work with them. And, you know, they're just driven to distraction, but they have to be ready to do the work. They really do have to be open and ready to do the work.
And I wonder how many people are actually ready, because I find in my healing business too, there's people who, you know, complain and want to have a better life. And, you know, a chunk of them are ready and willing and wanting. And then there's some that, like, you know, are just resistant.
I think some people like complaining.
I know they've got a habit of complaining, but not a habit of doing something to shift their consciousness in a way that would empower them.
I would say out of all of the divorcing people, there's probably 1-2% of people that actually want to do the work.
That's low.
To make the changes.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Okay. So what do you recommend for at least the small percentage that's ready to do it? What do you recommend for parents to be able to prioritize their kids in this divorce? Because, I mean, obviously they've got their own hurt, disrespect, grudges, pain, etc. But kids, you know, are innocent in this. How can they put those wounds aside and prioritize their children so they're not scarred for life until they get more healing for them too?
No, absolutely. I think one of the first things that I encourage people to do is to set boundaries. You know, decide what you are not going to tolerate. And is this going to be important next week, next month, next year? If it's not, don't worry about it. You know, if Bobby left his pencil case at the wrong house, get over it. It's, you know, if their lunchbox got lost at school or left in the wrong house or something, it's fine. It's not a massive drama. You know, they can put it in a bag and a plastic bag and put it in their backpack. You know, it's not the end of the world. Yet, you know, people wage war over this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know one of my clients said that he was traumatized by his parents basically stripping him down the minute they got back from the other parents, as if he couldn't infest their house with the clothes that he was wearing from the other parent. Wow. And that's toxic. I mean, that is, and he said, even now, you know, he's in his mid-40s, he will never do that to his child. Never. Mm-hmm. Because he was scarred by that, because it made him feel less than. So, yeah. So it's about thinking not just of themselves, but, you know, if they were watching somebody else do this to their child, would they have an opinion on that? You know, what would they say? What would they think? But, you know, it's about taking the ego away and taking, it can be a little bit of an ask sometimes, remove the ego, place it by the door. You can pick it back up on the way out. Yeah, it's just about putting themselves behind the needs of the child, not in front of. So what's best for the child? Is it best for the child to see their mum screaming at their father, chasing them down the driveway? You know, no. Is it best for the child? You know, even if the parents cannot even breathe the same air as each other, that's fine. There are solutions, you know. My son at 3 years old had a little Scooby-Doo backpack on wheels, like a little trolley bag, we packed it up for his nights away with daddy, and then he would take that to daddy's. I didn't have to enter his house. I didn't even have to walk up the path. I could stand at the gate. I could stand at the end of the drive, and he could walk himself up towards the front door where daddy would let him in. Don't even have to communicate. Get drop-offs and pickups done before or after school, you know. You've got the kid for the weekend, you pick them up from school on the Friday, and you drop them back to school on a Monday. You know, that's enough time to get the uniform washed. They can go back in the uniform that they came in, you know, and then they spend the rest of the week with mum. There are always solutions, but it's just sometimes people get so hung up on hurting the other person that they won't even consider any other solution apart from the one that they are thinking of. So it's about finding alternative solutions that might actually work better.
Do you also recommend lots of forgiveness?
Yes. Yeah. I think forgiveness for themselves as much as anything else, because we've all done it. We've all said things that we don't mean. We've all lost our rag, you know, whether it be in the car, driving along and somebody cuts you up on the freeway, or, you know, whether it be sort of in the supermarket and somebody's just rammed into your ankles for the 10th time with their trolley. You know, people make mistakes. People react sometimes without thinking, and we're all human. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to forgive others and try to appreciate where they're coming from, to see it from their perspective as well as our own. So it's about being able to again, just step back, breathe, and try and communicate in a way that is not designed specifically to create a war with the other person. So, you know, you can have, I mean, my son was the worst for school uniform. I don't know what he did. I think when he got to school in the morning, he would roll around in the leaves and the mud and then come out at the end of the day covered in, I don't know what. Walking disaster. But so we when I bought school uniform each year, so I'd buy it each year for as he was growing, and he would actually have 2 weeks worth of clothes. Every day would have a clean jumper, a clean shirt, a clean pair of trousers. When he went to his dad's, unless he was going somewhere special, he wouldn't have ultra fancy clothes. He would have just clothes. It didn't matter if they didn't come back, just clothes, you know. Nothing precious was sent with him, and nothing precious had to come back with him. Nothing was sent that would matter if it got lost. And as he was older, as he grew older, he began to sort of take his own accountability for what he took and brought back and what he didn't, you know, did and didn't take. And that's fine, because we expect them to think like we do, and they don't. nobody else thinks like we do. We're all unique. We all think in different ways.
So. Okay. I have one question that I find interesting. What do you think is an appropriate age for parents to buy their kids cell phones?
Okay. Now, I'll base it on my experience here and my experience as a parent. When our kids hit year six in school, which I suppose would be grade six, they're in that last year before they move up to the next big school.
To the middle school.
Yeah. That's the year when we start encouraging them to travel to and from school on their own, if possible, with friends. You know, they meet up on the corner and they all go to school together. And they'll hang out in the park before they come home, and they rolled around in leaves and things because, you know, he still came back looking like that. But that was the age when here it was, he was able to text me and say, oh, I'm at the park with my friends. I'll be home by five. Because I was a full-time working mum. So he needed to be able to communicate with me. His dad's house was actually nearer to the school for that particular year, for the last year of that school. But quite often he'd just come home to our house. He'd have a key. He'd have his phone. Or he'd go to his dad's and just let me know, oh, can you pick me up at dad's? And that's fine. Pick him up at dad's. But I never made a big deal out of it. I always bought the phone and paid for the contract because it wasn't about, you know, you pay for it, I pay for it, you know, can't use it on the other parent's time and all of that. It wasn't about that at all. It was purely about safety to and from school and logistics, knowing where to collect said child. Because there are pros and cons. If you don't let a child at school, if all of their peers have got phones, and if all of their peers communicate in that way through their phones, by not allowing your child to have a phone, there is an argument that you are actually deliberately excluding them from a social group by withholding that technology. And you are also not enabling them to become familiar and conversant with that technology to be able to operate in today's world. So my son had the phone, he was age 10, moving up to, you know, sort of moving up to age 11.
Because I see a lot of kids now, even at like age 6, 7. Eight, in that range, having cell phones. And I wonder, you know, given like how would you, as a real life example, mediate when one parent wants to give their kid a cell phone or really expensive technology or something like that at age 6 or 7, and the other parent's like, no, they're not old enough yet. How do you deal with that type of real life scenario?
Okay. Well, when they're with the other parent, that's the other parent's responsibility. So if the other parent has chosen to give them the phone at that age, that's absolutely fine. That is their choice and their decision. However, on arrival to the other parent's house, the one that is not happy with them having that phone, then if they chose to, they are more than within their rights to say, okay, phone time, phone goes in the box until you leave back to go to the other parent's house, and it's given back when they leave. The danger of this is that I have come across specific incidences where the other parent has put a tracker on that phone so that they can actually stalk the child and the other parent whilst they were out. They have put listening devices on the phones, or hidden in toys even, to try and, you know, create a drama out of nothing. And it's, my attitude is very much your house, your rules. You know, if the other parent wants to feed them lollipops for breakfast and pancakes for dinner, there's not really an awful lot you can do about that. But what you can do is you can teach your child about healthy eating and you can encourage them to experiment with healthy eating and cooking and doing all of that on your time. Because there is no court in the land that will force a parent of what is appropriate to eat when they're in their house. Mm-hmm. And it's the same goes for phones. If the other parent is determined to let them have a phone age 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever the age is, that's on them. But do we want the child to be a mindless robot to a handheld device, never looking up and never talking to anybody because they're constantly on their phone as it's a babysitter, effectively? Or if you feel that the child should have a phone and the other parent won't let them, then you have to allow yourself to accept that you don't get to say what happens in their house. So if the other parent says, I'm sorry, but the phone, I'm not comfortable with them having that phone. So when it arrives, it's going in a box. And then when they come back, they get it back. And whether that's a conversation that's actually had, or whether that's a conversation that goes through the lawyers, or whether that's a conversation that goes through the court or the parenting app or whatever.
Oh my gosh. You know,
it can be an absolute minefield. However, this is about boundaries. So this is about saying, this is what I'm going to accept. And I'm sorry, but if I only get limited time with my child, I don't want to spend that limited time trying to pry them away from a phone or an iPad or a laptop or whatever it is that they're messing about on. I want to be able to spend quality time with that child. But if I find that having a phone makes it easier for them to sit through their siblings' ballet lessons or karate lessons in peace and quiet, and they're happy until they get home, you know, there are arguments for and against on all sides, but it's kind of like your house, your rules has to be key. And by enforcing that boundary in your own house, you also have to respect that boundary for the other parent's house. That you force them to do something that you think is right, because that's your opinion. You have to allow them the grace to have their house, their rules. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And I know you've got a lot more gems and wisdom and some stuff that you've put together in an actual co-parenting guide. So can you tell us about your free gift?
Yeah, sure. It's called the Co-Parenting Resource Guide. And it's a selection of resources that have been tried and tested that people can actually, because as I said, when I was going through it, I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't know who to ask. But this actually gives you some ideas as to where to go, who to talk to, who to ask, various online resources that are available. The links are all in there. You can just click on them and just go straight to that page. And it's segregated off into different areas, so people can pick and choose what works for them and what doesn't. So an invaluable little piece of kit for your toolbox.
Nice. And I'll put that in the show notes section so that you guys can have access to that link as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, any other final words that you want to share with us?
I think my final words would be kind. Just be kind. You know, we don't know what other people are going through. So whatever the situation, whatever's going on, kindness costs nothing. And if we can't be kind, then we can at least be civil.
Thank you. All right. Have a beautiful rest of your day or night for you, since you're in the UK. And thank you for sharing your wisdom.
Oh,
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tiffany. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Much love and blessings to all.
Thank you for listening to Soul of an Empath with Tiffany Cano. If you enjoyed this show, please rate and recommend it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you are listening to it. You can get more information from soulofanempath.com. May you be blessed with love, health, peace, joy, spiritual oneness, prosperity, and abundance. So be it. So be it. So be it.